Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Monday, April 3rd. The indictment of Donald Trump is big, big, big in the media, but I feel like it's landing as a much littler thing, and even with a kind of emptiness of meaning, with some thoughtful people I know, because even a conviction of Trump in New York wouldn't solve anything about democracy versus authoritarianism, which is the real Donald Trump threat, not falsifying business records. He or a similar kind of candidate could still be elected president next year and keep cultivating a strongman kind of rule that runs on white, hetero, cisgender, male supremacy, even if Donald Trump is convicted in Manhattan criminal court. According to reporting I've seen in several news outlets, DA Alvin Bragg wanted Trump to come for an arraignment Friday, right after the existence of an indictment was revealed on Thursday evening. Apparently, Trump refused or negotiated and bought himself this four-day gap, presumably so he and his allies, from Ron DeSantis to Marjorie Taylor Greene, could gin up a protest crowd for when Trump appears. Taylor Greene says she'll be there at the courthouse in person tomorrow. DeSantis, as some of you have heard, appeared on Long Island over the weekend, ostensibly to promote his new book and to campaign for president against Trump. But nevertheless, he stoked Trump's claim that the indictment is a political witch hunt. DeSantis called it, quote, not the rule of law, unquote, on Long Island, even though that's exactly what an indictment by a grand jury of 23 randomly selected citizens who heard many witnesses is, the rule of law. Subtext from DeSantis: you commute into the city for work or the theater, why not for the protest too? There was no sign that DeSantis denounced Trump for threatening Bragg with a baseball bat in a photo Trump posted, or calling Bragg dehumanizing and racist names, or anything like that. So I guess we're about to hear a lot about hush money and extramarital affairs and the words porn star as often as the news media can say them, and falsifying business records, but maybe not so much about democracy being at stake outside of these proceedings. With me first, NYU law professor Melissa Murray, who was also co-host of the Legal Affairs podcast called Strict Scrutiny. Professor Murray, good to have you on again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
What do you think is at stake in this prosecution on as small or as grand a level as you might be thinking about it?
Well, I agree with you that this is probably the less important legal news story of the week. I agree with you that the Wisconsin Supreme Court election is probably the bigger story, but this will certainly garner the lion's share of the media attention, and that's unfortunate. But, you know, there's a lot at stake. And interestingly, I think there are a lot of people who are aligned on both sides. I think the one thing that everyone, whether on the left or on the right, wants right now is to see a photograph of Donald Trump doing some kind of perp walk. And they want it for different reasons. The left, because they have been baying for blood for some time for Donald Trump. And Donald Trump would like this because it will be incredibly advantageous in stoking his claims that he is the victim of a liberal witch hunt that ends here at the New York courthouse.
Can Trump continue to live in Florida after indictment? Because sometimes we hear that defendants are told not to leave the state.
Well, it will depend on what Judge Merchan, Justice Merchan, has to say at the arraignment on Tuesday. So there may be additional conditions that are placed on the defendant. He may have to surrender his passport. There may be conditions about staying within the jurisdiction. So all of that, I think, will be left to the judge, and we'll learn more about it, and certainly more about the charges that have been levied against Donald Trump on Tuesday at that arraignment.
And also with us now, Jonathan Lemire, Politico's White House bureau chief and co-host of Way Too Early on MSNBC, 5 a.m. weekdays, and a central presence on their following show, Morning Joe. Jonathan, thanks for extending your workday for the benefit of our listeners. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, a pleasure as always. Thank you.
You know, I was talking before about how big this case is in the media, but perhaps how small compared to real threats Donald Trump poses which are not about falsifying business records, if that's the charge, but more about trying to transition this country to a kind of authoritarian rule based on identity politics of race and gender and sexual orientation and religion. How much do you agree or disagree as a political analyst that this may be good political theater, but it's a low-stakes storyline compared to what's really important regarding Donald Trump?
Yeah, this really feels like the opening act, if you will. And I know there are some who complain, Democrats in particular, that this case went first, fearful of the tone of consent. Obviously, though, there's no coordination between the various prosecutions. But you're right. This is the smallest stakes. It's the charges that face Trump, and we, of course, will learn no more about them tomorrow when the indictment is unsealed, are far less significant than would the other three active and open investigations. The one in Georgia about election interference in that state, and then the two that are being done by Jack Smith, special counsel, one over Trump's mishandling of classified documents at Mar-a-Lago, and perhaps more to the point, his efforts to obstruct the DOJ's moves to get them back. And then, of course, everything about January 6th. So that's in terms of the legal matter. Those seem to be far more serious. Politically, I think we have two distinct answers here. One, this is, polls suggest, potentially a boon to Donald Trump temporarily in the short term in the Republican primary field. That said, I think you'd be very hard pressed to argue anything other that this would hurt him. Any of these cases would hurt him in a general election when he's trying to win back independent and swing voters he lost in 2020.
Yeah, well, that remains to be seen. You know, Jonathan, there are a lot of things that people thought in the past would hurt Donald Trump politically, and they wound up either not hurting him or maybe even helping him. And, you know, we can all go all the way back to the beginning of the 2016 presidential campaign when he said the Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly was bleeding from her whatever. Mm-hmm. We thought that was going to be the end of Trump when he said John McCain wasn't a war hero. He's only considered a hero because he was captured. We thought that was going to be the end of Donald Trump. The Access Hollywood tape, all those things arguably helped him. So why think this would be any different?
Yeah, I was in the room for most of those. And you're right. I mean, certainly right now, especially when it comes to Republicans, it's only helping him. And I think, look, he has made the case that this particular prosecution he is suggesting is biased. He is suggesting it's politically motivated. And he's suggesting this is something that's many years old that most Americans don't care about. And polling backs him up to a degree. But of course, there's also the ethos that no man is above the law. But in terms of short-term political gain, right now, what this has done is it has rallied Republicans around him. His base has always been there, the MAGA base. It has shrunk over the years, but still bigger than anyone else in the Republican field, certainly. Even if it's shrunk, it's also hardened. The fervor of his supporters is still very much there. And what he has done effectively is force other Republicans, including many of those who are looking to run against him in the primary field, to also come out and bash this investigation. You know, good faith or not, they're all singing the same from the same song sheet. About how this is politically motivated and so on and so on. So right now, this investigation in particular, response to it is breaking down along party lines. That may be different for other probes that could be coming later this year. But right now, on the eve of this arraignment, it's only helped him in the Republican primary.
Professor Murray, Jonathan mentioned that this may only be the opening act before an indictment from Georgia on trying to interfere with the election results there. We know about the phone call to the Secretary of State of Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, and all of that. It may be a prelude, an opening act to an indictment from Washington, from the special counsel in the U.S. Justice Department on January 6th related charges or classified documents related charges. What if all those charges come down and this Manhattan prosecution is going on at the same time? How does the legal system sort out what happens when?
Well, that's a terrific question, Brian. Again, uncharted waters for us. The prospect of a former president indicted is certainly unprecedented, but to have him indicted on numerous charges, both at the state and federal level in different jurisdictions, I think is completely unprecedented. And how it would all be sorted out is a sort of a broader question. Again, if he was in fact the president and there was this case was still going on. I mean, again, I think there are real questions. We certainly have a precedent of Ulysses S. Grant being charged with a misdemeanor, speeding in his carriage in New York State while he was president. But we've never had a situation where there have been felony charges leveled at the state level on a current president or president-elect or a former president for that matter. And so we are literally in uncharted waters. I mean, again, as other people have noted, this is not necessarily unprecedented for other systems. We have plenty of systems where former leaders have been subject to indictment once they've left office. You know, query whether that makes us more or less like these other systems and whether that is or is not a good thing. But I think the thing to just underscore here is we have never had a situation like this, and this is sort of a perfect storm of criminal liability, and that will be very difficult for the legal system to shake out.
Jonathan, there was, and all this media coverage of the Trump indictment obscured this, there was an actual anti-Trump Republican who declared for president over the weekend, and that is former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson. He said he's running on ABC this week, yesterday, and he told the country why. Listen.
And the reason, as I've traveled the country for 6 months, I hear people talk about the leadership of our country, and I'm convinced that people want leaders that appeal to the best of America and not simply appeal to our worst instincts.
Does someone like Asa Hutchinson have a shot in the world, Jonathan, at this nomination, given the Republican mood that you were describing earlier? I'm scratching my head seeing him even get into the race.
It seems very unlikely in the Republican Party of the year 2023, the Donald J. Trump Republican Party. That this was 10, 20 years ago, someone like Governor Hutchinson would make a lot of sense for what the GOP used to be. There doesn't really seem to be a lane for him right now or anyone like him. And two other thoughts here. I think it is telling and instructive that the only candidates in the Republican field or prospective candidates who are really criticizing Trump right now are Governor Hutchinson, former Governor Hutchinson, and former Governor Chris Christie, both of whom are polling at about 1% and not seen as real viable challengers. The other Republicans are more loath to do so because they know that Trump is the favorite and they can't win the nomination themselves. If they don't win it, if they alienate all of Trump's supporters, they need at least some of them in order to do so. But I'm not sure there is an anti-Trump lane necessarily, or at the very least, maybe there's a two-person race here in Trump and Governor DeSantis, were he indeed to jump in as expected. Trump has really opened up his lead over DeSantis, depending on the poll. It could be 15, 20, 30 points. But DeSantis, at least for now, that's where the anti-Trump forces have coalesced around him, while everyone else, the Pences, the Pompeos, the Haleys, these other candidates are all doing in the single digits. And DeSantis, though, doesn't come with some of the baggage, perhaps, that Trump does. I mean, his politics and policies are pretty similar and a lot of very radical, people think, in many ways. So therefore, they're not sure there even is a mainstream lane for someone like even, let's say, a Glenn Youngkin, the governor of Virginia, to enter. Like, these are people who on paper would be prospective, quote, moderate candidates in the GOP field. But there really isn't a modern mainstream lane anymore. It's just what type of MAGA-esque politics do you want, Trump or DeSantis?
And maybe Arkansas is a perfect example of that, where Asa Hutchinson was the governor. Now it's Governor Sanders, right, who was Trump's press secretary.
Yeah.
And we see what kinds of speeches she's been giving. But here's a little more of Hutchinson on ABC yesterday, and I want to get your reaction to something he says here, too. Listen.
It's still about retail politics in many of these states. And also, this is one of the most unpredictable political environments that I've seen in my lifetime. And so my message of experience, of consistent conservatism, of hope for our future, and solving problems that face Americans, I think that resonates.
Do you agree, Jonathan, that we're in an unpredictable political environment? I could argue it's very predictable. Republican America finds its expression in Donald Trump for the most part, and the Democrats debate a line from Joe Bidenism to Bernie Sandersism.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I think that the day-to-day feels turbulent and feels unpredictable just because we're suddenly back in that news cycle where there's extraordinary headlines seemingly every hour generated largely by Donald Trump or, you know, world events. But the parties seem fairly fixed. I mean, yes, there's definitely a greater, frankly, divide among Democrats in terms of ideology, as you just mentioned, the Biden to Bernie lanes. But at the end of the day, at least for now, there's no sense that party would split. You know, if President Biden, as is expected, runs for re-election, there may be some progressives who grumble. But, you know, we certainly see some polls who suggest that enthusiasm behind Biden is not that great, but there's no real expectation that there'll be a fracturing of the party, that someone will challenge Biden for the nomination. It's expected that most Democrats will get on board. And then for the Republicans, yes, there's certainly a minority there, but a very quiet minority that would like to turn the page from Trump. That's what they say privately, but publicly, they're not doing it because they're afraid of Trump. And more importantly, they're afraid of Trump's base. So the Republican Party is still very much in Trump's grasp. And at least for now, despite the turbulence of the last few years in American politics, more than likely, we're destined for a rematch of 2020. So that's about as predictable as it gets if we get Biden and Trump again.
Here's a question for Professor Murray from Marita in Brooklyn. Marita, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. I wanted to ask why no one is discussing about a comparison between the trial of John Edwards and this trial. I mean, I know that David Brooks mentioned it briefly on Friday night, but no one's really discussing it. I mean, especially since John Edwards got off.
Yes, and we've talked about it on this show, but Professor Murray, to remind people briefly, John Edwards, when he was running for president, got caught in an affair, and then he was charged criminally with basically paying hush money to his mistress to cover up the affair during his presidential campaign. And he got off on the defense that, no, he was really hushing her up to preserve his marriage so his wife wouldn't find out, rather than the electorate. And I guess the jury bought that. Is that an accurate description of the John Edwards case?
It's mostly accurate. And I will say some people have been talking about it. I've certainly talked about it when covering this in the media. It's an apt comparison, although there are some important distinctions. The John Edwards case was obviously brought in federal court on federal charges. This is obviously a state and local case. So that's a difference. This is a case where the government has the burden of proving these charges beyond a reasonable doubt. And for whatever reason, if the jury believes that the government has failed to meet its burden, the defendant will be acquitted of these charges. So again, there is a process here. Like whether or not you think this is politically motivated or whether or not you think this will play out in a particular way in politics, law is different from politics. And this will play out on a legal scale with jurors and a judge. And there will ultimately be a legal standard that the government and not Donald Trump must meet.
Politico White House Bureau Chief and MSNBC Way Too Early, 5 a.m. weekdays host Jonathan Lemire, NYU Law Professor Melissa Murray, also co-host of the Legal Affairs podcast Strict Scrutiny. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.